Good morning, good morning, good morning. Al Bergeson, your host for another edition of Smart Talk. Today's December 7th, Pearl Harbor attack. And you think about how America pulled together to fight a war across the Pacific. Today, when you think about our politics, it's as if the war is at home, not across the Pacific, but in different parts of the country. The heartland of red states seemingly permanently opposed to bi-coastal blue states across the aisle in Congress. It's as if we are at war with ourselves, and maybe in some sense we are at war with ourselves. So today, not just because it's Pearl Harbor Day, but that certainly was a great way to start the show and for all of us to remember times when being an American was a category or a social identity that included all of us and made us all feel very good about it. But to think about the impeachment. And so we want to talk about both the election and the impeachment proceedings, which it looks like, as Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has said, that she is going to go ahead and bring impeachment charges against President Trump. So my guest today to talk about some of this is Chris Segrin. Chris is a longtime friend at the university and a professor of communications. Chris has been on the show before, and it's great to have Chris back. Chris, let me just start off with you. Welcome.
Thank you, Al. It's great to be with you.
It's good to see you. It's good to see you back sitting across from me here at the KVOI studios. Again, for those of you who might just be tuning in, 790-2040. 790-2040. That's not my IQ. That is the call-in number. So please call in with any opinion you have about the 2020 presidential election or about the present impeachment proceedings, which we are right in the middle of. So, Chris, thinking about the way things are going and the Democrats moving ahead in the House, as a communications professor, you got any thoughts about things people are doing right, things people are doing wrong, how if you were in charge of someone's campaign or you had Nancy Pelosi's ear, Nancy, come here, just a minute, will you? Here's the way I think you ought to pitch it, or Adam Schiff. Adam, I got some ideas for you. Take it.
Well, I think there's much to be criticized on both sides, so let's just take it one at a time. And correct me if I'm wrong here, Al, but generally in Washington, D.C., one party does not have the numbers to impeach a president on their own. What that means is they have to work with their colleagues on the other side of the aisle. That's just a must. Here's something that isn't common to social interactions and conflicts in politics, in trial law, in military and war, in marriage and family, and in sports. And it's this: you never start a battle that you can't finish, right? Al, why play a game you can't win? The issue here is this: for a skilled communicator, when they're facing a conflict of this sort, what they need to do is some background work, some research, some caucusing with their opponents to try to figure out, do I have the wherewithal to pull this off? And why is that? Because when you start a battle and don't win the battle, you always end up weaker than when you went into it.
I hear that. I can imagine people saying, I got you, Chris. But what if you're someone who the injustice is so great that even though you may not win, you need to start or you need to do something? That is it worse to lose in a noble battle than to be silent and not say anything about what's going on? I mean, protest movements, revolutions, any number of things, the odds were very low, but people felt compelled to do it. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, do you really think that if you couldn't calculate you could win, it wasn't important to get the data out about what the president had done, or at least to express yourself to your own base?
Well, first of all, the interesting thing is what the silence that you're describing is actually the flaw of the Republican communication strategy. You know, so that you're absolutely right. I mean, both sides of the aisle would be in this dilemma where if they said nothing, they'd end up looking badly. But let's just play this out as a sort of thought experiment. Let's say they move forward with the impeachment and they end up not getting it. What this is going to do is actually embolden the president and his supporters. It will support this left-wing conspiracy theory that there's just a bunch of crackpots out to get me. And he'll take that as evidence that I did nothing wrong, right? We've already seen him do that when people take a crack at him for doing something wrong that really was wrong, but they didn't succeed in making a big enough deal out of it. Mueller report, for example. He'll spin that as evidence. See, it proves that I did nothing wrong. That's the danger. You actually empower your opponent and you weaken yourself. But you're right. You've taken a moral high ground position. The difficulty that the Republicans face right now is exactly the one that you framed here, and that is that silence will be seen as being complicit in this unfortunate conduct. And that is going to be a real challenge. And that's where the messaging from the Republicans is in a really bad spot. With that said, let's keep in mind, the president kind of put them in that spot, right? Because here's another thought experiment. What if he would have said, you know, I did get a little bit carried away, and I really didn't mean this to be a quid pro quo, and I talked to my counsel, and we're going to be more careful in the future. Sort of, you know, my bad, mea culpa. And then the Republicans can go, well, he did make some mistakes, but we're still behind him. What did he say instead? It was a perfect call. He puts them in an untenable position. Now they have to support the it's a perfect call routine. And that's a very, very difficult message to stand behind.
Your logic from the point of view of a communications theorist and researcher makes perfect sense about don't start something if you can't finish it. Why do you think Speaker Pelosi, who initially I think had all the assumptions you made, this will only embolden him, this will only embolden the Republicans, will look like we're chasing our tail and getting nowhere, why did she decide to go ahead?
My hunch is that she's playing a hypothesis. She's obviously smart enough, as are these other elected officials, to know that they don't have the support on the Republican side to pull this off. So I have a hunch that what they're doing is playing a game whereby they're hoping that by bringing all these facts out into the daylight for the public to see, that the public will start to shame the Republicans into, you've got to take this guy down. I think that's her long game. I can't prove it. But it's the only thing that makes sense, because she's got to be have the ability to count and go, I don't have the Republican support to pull this off.
Or if it's not to win an impeachment vote, it is to perhaps bring enough stuff up that the 2020 election next November might be tilted.
Right.
One could say that the impeachment is really almost the starting gun for the 2020 election, and it has nothing to do with It does have something to do with the charges, but in some sense, it's also involved in the 2020 thing. If you're a Republican, why do you think so many of them stick with the president on this, and you don't get maybe not, I got to decide? Why are they all seem to be so marching behind him?
That is an excellent question, Al. You know, and I hope the listeners will appreciate that politics in our country has changed in the last 20 to 30 years. Washington, D.C., when you get elected and you go out to Washington, D.C., you're effectively joining a prison gang. When you go to prison, you have to join the gang to survive. And the gang will sometimes make you do things that you don't want to do, and you have to do them for your own survival. And politics in Washington, D.C. has become a prison gang.
Why?
That's a great question. I'm not exactly clear why it has turned this way, but that it has, that if you step out of line from your party, you've had it at the next election. They'll throw you to the wolves and consume you, and it's over with. I think some of it has to do with a mass identity that each party has cultivated and just feels that their safest bet is to not step out of line with that.
And I think that's a good point. I think it's a safest bet because something has changed with the electorate on the Republican side. That is, in some sense, politicians are about getting elected, which is good and bad. You'll do anything,
right,
seemingly bad. You're responsible to people, the good. And so facing challenges at home from more conservative people scares the bejesus out of all politicians.
Correct.
But in this case, particularly Republicans, which takes us to the next step. What is it about the electorate in red states that has them feel so enraged about Trump and so anti-democratic and so much for draining the swamp?
I think if you look carefully in the last 10 to 20, maybe even 25 years, there has been a growing dissatisfaction with Washington, D.C. and how things are run there, and we're looking for something different. So much so that now the maverick has come to town, and people like that. And the quest for something different, this draining the swamp thing, is so powerful that it's literally causing people to overlook what appear to be fairly obvious wrongdoings. But if it's done in the name of this maverick, sort of buck the system, people really like that.
I think it's true. And I think there's another element too. You just toss something on, you can respond to that. I'll be the guest and you be the host. The Democrats, as a party of Roosevelt, as a party of the working man, has shifted its focus some, such that when you think about the heartland for unemployment, you think about robotization taking jobs, you think about what they call the deaths of despair, that is the rising rates of suicide, opiate abuse, drug abuse, that alcoholism, that is concentrated in white, high school educated, 25 to 55 year old males, that is massively dramatic. That actual condition for a lot of people has them almost up to a wall that we are at the edge, and the Democratic Party does not seem to have focus on that. Neither did the Republicans.
Right.
So in came Donald Trump and 12 Republican candidates of, quote, traditional conservatism, gone, vanquished. Then Hillary, it's for me, it's my time, and nice sounding thing. Well, he barely won, and she got the majority vote. But people who complain about that got to remember, you show up to a baseball game in football gear and say, I scored more touchdowns. And they go, you idiot.
Right.
You never heard of the electoral system, the electoral college? That's what you got to fight for.
That's right.
John, it's time to take a break. Folks, stick with us. We're going to talk more about the Republicans and the Democrats and the impeachment proceedings with Chris Segrin from the University of Arizona. Smart Talk, Al Bergeson, your host, coming to you today on Pearl Harbor Day with my guest, Chris Segrin, professor of communications, also head of the communications department, longtime head of the communications department at the University of Arizona. And we're talking about the impeachment proceedings, in good part because Speaker Pelosi has said she wants to go ahead in the House and actually bring some things. We're also going to talk some about the election in 2020 and the different positions on people. And I'd like to start out by imagining, it sounds like Maureen Dowd in her famous New York Times columns, Inside Al Gore's Head. And I would like to do a little bit about inside Donald Trump's head. And then, Chris, I'm going to ask you to respond to it.
Okay.
So this is all hypothetical, folks, just making this up because you're driving along, give you something to think about. So you could imagine Donald Trump, President Trump, talking to some Democrats, and particularly the more excitable and angry ones about his presidency. And he says, you know, you guys are absolutely right. You know, I am everything you say I am. I have the womanizing problem. You people in religion, I'm surprised you're not more angry at me. I've done this, shortcomings in business. I've never held any kind of office. I'm deplorable. You're absolutely right. But take a minute to think. You couldn't even beat that. Never mind me. What does that say about you? If I am everything you say I am, and I'll admit it, what are you? Because you couldn't even beat me.
Great point, Al, and that's a difficult question to answer.
I know, it's a tough one to just throw into you cold.
It reflects, I think, the dissatisfaction and disenfranchisement of a big segment of society who feels that the politicians, on left or right, are not representing their voice. And along comes this, let's call it what it is, a character who's going to play a role, be the maverick, go do, you know, break out of the tradition. I'm not rooted. I don't care about whether I get reelected or not. I have enough money. They like that because they feel this is now my champion. And even though the exterior might be a bit rough around the edges and some of the behaviors might not fit with their ideologies, I think the idea that this individual for the first time is going to represent my voice, my concerns, true or not, that's the belief. It makes it very difficult for anybody from a sort of standard political orientation to come up against that, because they're just convinced that you are not, you're representing your own interests, not mine.
Yeah, I think the Democratic Party in 2016 clearly did not see, as the Republicans didn't either, as candidates in the primaries, the pain that was in certain parts of America.
Yes.
And I mean, the famous things where Hillary didn't even campaign in the upper Midwest industrial states, even though her husband Bill said, honey, you got to do that. And she thought that there were enough other votes elsewhere to do it. 790-2040, that's our call-in number, 790-2040. Call in, express an opinion, react to our guests, or react to me. One thing that's interesting and maybe somewhat helpful for understanding today, but not to completely dismiss your getting involved in this, is the fact that America has had a number of these kinds of incidents. And because it's an immigrant country, wave after wave of people have come to America. And as they come to not just enjoy life, but find a place in America and rise up in the political system, groups that were already here sometimes find themselves displaced. So you can go back to the famed progressive movement at the turn of the 20th century, in which a wave of immigrants from Eastern, Central, and Southern Europe came here, and an older WASP America that had run things felt displaced because of the sheer numbers, the growth of big cities, new industry, and cleaning up the city, historians have argued, was as much attacking the machine for being corrupt, but the machine, the political machine, was also the way in which immigrants gained control over the city or employment or other kinds of things. So we got someone on the air. We'll get back to this in the middle, but I don't want to lose our caller. Greg, comment.
Hey, guys. I've had the good fortune of being able to watch these impeachment hearings. When I say that, what I mean is, instead of speaking in generalities, I can tell you specifically that, as you both probably know, in law, evidence is one thing, hearsay is another thing. So the president makes a phone call, and I didn't hear any evidence of the fact that he said, listen, this money for the weaponry is not coming unless you dig into this Hunter Biden thing. So the bottom line is, it's as though we're shooting the messenger. He finds out, or the word was out, that Hunter Biden, who has no experience in natural gas or oil, made millions of dollars, and he's asking to dig deeper. And or if he's not, then it was Rudy Giuliani. But I think the focus, that spotlight, needs to shift from the president to Joe Biden and his son, and what Ukraine wanted to do for the son in return for favors from Biden, presumably when he was vice president. So give me another moment, because I will tell you that because of my age, I was born in 1949, I've seen what you were both addressing insofar as this shift from bipartisanship, John McCain's brand of democracy. I was a fan of his because he spoke what was on his mind, and he was a mediator. He tried to, you know, he had help from both the Democrats and his party. We don't see that very much anymore. But what I did see in watching the hearings, and this is what makes me feel good, I saw Republicans come to the front and say, listen, you got nothing on the guy. You're coming out here, this Schiff character, my gosh. Somebody should have said to him, Adam, look, you look like a fool out there. You're shutting these people up with parliamentary procedure. You look like an idiot. Give them time to talk. Because it was very one-sided. If you've seen it, you know what I'm speaking of. But as I started to say, what's great is that this support that Donald Trump has from his party, it makes me feel good. Because up until the point of watching the hearings, I thought he was on his own. I thought he was the maverick that you were talking about.
Greg, thank you. I appreciate your call. I'm going to turn it over to my guest here, and I'll have a few comments myself to respond to your call. Thanks again, Greg.
Greg, yeah, excellent points there. Really appreciate your input on this. And I tend to agree with a lot of your observations. One thing I would highlight, though, is I think what we learned during the Nixon administration and during the Clinton administration, that when it comes to articles of impeachment, you brought up the issues of evidence versus hearsay. And ideally, right, we would like to work with evidence. But what this ends up boiling down to a lot of times is perception. You know, there's an old saying in communication, we say this a lot too, perception is everything. You know, it isn't always about exactly what is, but how people see it. Go back to the Clinton, if you remember that impeachment proceeding. You know, did his lying about this relationship with this intern really rise to the level of an impeachable offense? It's a funny how that history is sort of repeating itself, and we're asking ourselves that very same question right now. This phone call, this offer, and whether how clear the offer was, and you know, then there was questions with Clinton about how you know what sort of was it really a serious relationship, and was it threatening national security anyway, and really what's the big deal? You know, that was some of the questions and the rhetoric of the time. So in many ways, we're revisiting that, and it boils back down to that issue, not so much of evidence, but of perception and how people look at that.
The other thing is, let me just follow up here. The other thing is that, as they say, an impeachment proceeding is not a legal, it's a political. High crimes and misdemeanor is vaguely put so that a lot of things that aren't technical can be employed in a political process that someone is not managing their office appropriately. If someone was doing a tit-for-tat thing on the phone, knowing people were listening, and you were as skilled a negotiator and wheeler-dealer in the very rough-and-tumble world of building in New York City, do you imagine you would just say, "Hi, listen, you cannot, I will give you $456,000 if you say three ads on television in America against someone running against me"? No. These things are always done subtly. You need a better reason for pulling up the, pulling back the money to be given to Ukraine, I think. Other than thinking you really wanted them to investigate corruption, and the particular corruption you had in mind happened also to be your political opponent. But the good part of what you said is that it brings to bear how this country is now split. People on one side are totally convinced of this, and people on the other side are totally convinced on the other side. And so in some sense, I'm beginning to wonder, is it really the issues, or are these sort of symbolic for a deeper kind of division in the American social fabric and in the American soul that's manifest politically, but really the pains underneath? It's like someone screams, and you're talking about the screaming, but in point of fact, you're not looking at the hammer hitting on their hand. And that is what I think we need to turn our attention to get a better grasp of that. Chris?
You're spot on there, Al. I think we're to the point now where the way parties are supporting their own personnel are such that, again, to go back to Greg's point, I'm not sure evidence matters a whole lot. I think we've gotten to a point in 2019 where a president of the United States could walk down Pennsylvania Boulevard with an aluminum baseball bat and start smashing car windows and taillights, and the party would just go, "Well, okay, that's fine." Because you don't dare speak out against your own party. That person is, it's a symbolic thing. They represent your aspirations, your dreams, your desires. And to speak out against that person and weaken that person by saying, "Hey, what that individual's doing is wrong," is just seen as is intolerable. That's a difference today in 2019 from what we saw back in the olden days, when people would come present the evidence, as Greg talked about, and reasonable people would digest that evidence and say, "You know what? Yeah, that break-in at Watergate and that attempt to cover up, that was wrong." You know, and they were willing to do that. Today, they're not willing anymore.
Al Bergeson here on Smart Talk with Chris Seagren, University of Arizona Communications Department, distinguished head and great scholar. And we're talking about the impeachment, Republicans and Democrats. We're going to get to the election a little bit, but right now we're just on the impeachment proceedings. 790-2040. Please give us a call. Express your opinion. Tell us what you're thinking about what we're talking about. Let me go back for a second and continue my little march through American history. So there was a protest movement then. In the 1960s, there was protest both sides, folks wanting in, fighting against a system that kept them out, the African-American riots in many major cities, Watts, Detroit, Newark, you're aware of, and also a kind of white protest of what was yesterday's immigrants, Eastern, Southern, Central Europeans, that as you're talking about it, Italians, Jews, Poles, et cetera, that had come to America. They were negatively reacting to the fact of rising black power in cities, and pretty soon you began to have, with the help of the federal government, African-American mayors for the first time. And then it changes again, at least in Los Angeles, where you have a riot in 1992, and in some sense, it's so much African-Americans protesting to get in, as in some sense with the arrival of Asian Americans into South Central Los Angeles, Hispanics, that in some sense, and the out-migration of African Americans, that you get a group now feeling like the WASPs before, or the Eastern Europeans before coming to America, that they are now being displaced. And so what's happened now is that the issue is less at the city level. It's almost national. In some sense, in a post-industrial sort of world, heartland America and jobs and culture and whatever is under attack or is passing. And in some sense, there is a defensive reaction to that. Folks, hang on. We're going to come back. We're going to turn after this to the 2020 election. You can still talk about impeachment if you want. Stay with us. Welcome back. Al Bergeson, Smart Talk. I'm your host. My guest, Chris Segrin, professor of communications. I almost said sociology. And he gave me that look like, no, Al, it's a professor of communications and the distinguished and longtime department head there. We're going to switch now to the 2020 election. Chris, let me throw out two people who are surprising us in the popularity they seem to be having so far on the Democratic side. Pete Buttigieg, small-time mayor from South Bend, Indiana, home of Notre Dame, who is sort of that middle America, and Kamala Harris, who seemingly represents the new wave of Democrats. One is doing well, you wouldn't think so. The other is doing not so well and dropped out. Your thoughts?
I think Harris made a very intelligent decision. I think she was reading the tea leaves. I think she's doing better before her dropping out than a number of other people who are still in the game. But I think she came to the realization that it was not going to happen. I think that was an intelligent move on her part. I think she has a fair number of support, and a lot of people are talking about the possibility of her being a vice presidential candidate. And so she may still reemerge. But we read an interesting opinion article in the New York Times the other day about how prosecutors very rarely translate well.
That's interesting.
Politicians, because a prosecutor, Al, is really a technician who works in a very limited domain of facts, presses a case, moves on to the next case. They don't ever have to play the long game. They don't have to ever organize an entire government. This is where Pete might be doing very well coming out of South Bend, Indiana, where even though it's a small town mayor, he has a bigger picture. He has to run a city, you know, and he's in the heartland, where we were talking before about the sort of disenfranchised voices of the heartland who feel that politicians are really representing Los Angeles and New York, right? Let's be honest. And this idea of someone coming from somewhere other than California who's in touch with the sort of common person, the working class on the streets. South Bend, Indiana is not anything like San Francisco or New York or Boston. And I think there's a certain appeal there. She, on the other hand, I think, again, was probably smart enough to realize I'm going to burn a lot of resources if I hang in this race and I just don't really have the numbers. And again, I think that shows a greater insight than some of the other people who are still hanging in who really don't have a chance at it. Although some of them are hanging in largely because they want the microphone on the stage.
Yeah, and also like Andrew Yang, hanging in makes sense because at some point someone might say, you know, I love your ideas and I want to encourage you to run for the House seat and we will raise money for you. And so this could be the beginning of a campaign.
Exactly.
And let me ask you a couple of quick questions. Kamala attacked Joe Biden. You're a communications advisor. Would you advise her to do it or not afterwards? Would you say do it again or would you say, let's pull back?
I would say let's pull back.
Why?
I don't think the rhetoric of attacking is serving a lot of people very well. I think in the long run, what Americans want is this idea of collegiality and working together, getting things done through cooperation, through influence, old school influence, rather than putting on the boxing gloves and going after people. There's so much of that. It's hard to get that kind of message above the dust storm that's already out there loaded with those kind of messages.
After she did it, there was a boost in her poll numbers. They then petered off. You mentioned something I want to follow up on and put something else for you to think about. You would talk about Kamala Harris being a prosecutor and the difficulty of that. Another way to look at that possibly is that you're someone who attacks all the time, and a bit of warmth on the trail of hearing. I always think of Bill Clinton. I feel your pain.
Mm-hmm.
Laugh at it, whatever you want, but the guy was just magical in terms of making making touch with people. I had this thought sitting here that in a way, was Kamala Harris a little like Megyn Kelly, who also was a prosecutor, on Fox News, where attack was the modality, she was great. Having left, for reasons we can, cannot, or do, will not get into, trying to do a normal morning show with guests, that format, not that she attacked all the time, but it didn't warm up and the numbers didn't appear and it sort of faltered. Here's the question. Is it the case when women, whether it's Kamala the prosecutor or Megan, the great question, get to the bottom, almost attacked too, she also was a lawyer, when women do that, they are stereotyped as too tough or too angry and they have a niceness bias or baggage that they carry that you would not find with a male candidate who attacked?
Absolutely right. Let's begin with the observation that to succeed as a prosecutor, you have to be something of a pit bull and you have to be somewhat thick-skinned. And that does go against what we often see as gender stereotypes for preferred communication styles. And that just like men who are compassionate and expressive and considerate might be seen as somewhat feminine and then viewed negatively that way, women who are seen as somewhat instrumental and demanding and forceful sometimes bear the burden. And it goes back to the point we made earlier. It's about perception, unfortunately. And these are the mass perceptions that sometimes women who have that tough exterior, which often is to their benefit in a case like being a prosecutor, in other arenas that does not translate very well. I'm not here to say it's right or wrong. I'm just here to say that's the way human beings perceive sometimes men and women and when they behave in what we call gender sort of deviant expectations.
Or what they call the likability factor.
Absolutely.
And Hillary was also right or wrong saddled with that, and it didn't work. Last minute, not last minute, but most recent entrance into the Democratic primary is Mayor Mike Bloomberg, ex-Mayor Mike Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of his initial strategy of aligning himself with Moms Against Violence and the anti-gun movement?
It's an interesting one and a risky one. It's interesting in that clearly we have as a society a thirst for some sort of quenching of this gun violence problem. There, I mean, that is a position that makes some political sense given what's happening in the news on a weekly basis. With that said, he's up against a group of people who seem to be empowered by President Trump's election who are taking a very, very different position on that. And so it's risky in that regard. He's swimming against the tide, but is it a topic that's on everybody's mind? Absolutely.
I'm going to take the other side. I think it's a brilliant first move. He's very much well aware of the liberal wing of the party. He's very much, I'm guessing, he's very much well aware of his stop and frisk policy and the backlash from African-American community and op-ed writers, et cetera, et cetera. And so he needs to jump in. He's also aware of being labeled the billionaire. You just can't buy it. I'm channeling Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders. So what does he do? What do his advisors say? They say, okay, what on the liberal side have you long time been involved in? Used your money for selflessly because you weren't running for office, guns. So here is your entrance into this today's Democratic Party that no one can initially argue with. You could now say, yes, I'm a billionaire and I've spent loads of money. On what? Anti-gun stuff. I'm one of your people. Stop it. And you also have a cadre of activists in the anti-gun movement nationally, has loads of activists who you can mobilize to get out initially for you. From that is my guess that they will say once the foot's in the door, the camel's nose is under the tent, put it another way, that you will then move for the other foot and broaden it enough to get some electoral or Democratic Party votes in this primary to move forward.
You're right. And the question is whether the timing is correct. If he's thinking carefully, we know full well, right? Anybody who's been paying any attention to politics in this country in the last 50 years knows it's a pendulum. It swings back and forth, back and forth. So with the last election, it kind of swung to the right. Big, great time for the NRA, great time for the Republicans. And now, is he going to potentially ride that momentum of the pendulum swinging back? If it is indeed starting to swing back away from pro-NRA, right-wing, he may be at just the right person at the right time. But I think he's got a little baggage in his background that's going to make it difficult. And he's up against some pretty good challengers.
Absolutely. 790-2040. 790-2040. That's the call-in number. We're here with Chris Segrin, professor of communications at the U of A. We're talking about the 2020 election and most recently talking about Mike Bloomberg's decisions to enter into the race. It is interesting that Bloomberg has had a touch-and-go should I, shouldn't I approach to things electorally. And in the past, he's tried to decide whether to enter and not to enter. He sort of did the same thing here. And that hesitancy, you can almost see Donald Trump saying, you know, I may be, again, I may be everything you say I am, but, you know, I gave it a go. And I just stepped in there. Same thing with Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean, I think he saw some weakness in the California thing, rolled the dice. I think Mike Bloomberg is trying it this time, and we will have to see how that turns out. Okay, let's play the odds makers, Las Vegas. Who do you think has the best chance of taking the Democratic nomination, and why?
I'm going to have to go with the easy one, Al, here, unfortunately. It seems that Biden has a really good crack at it, and I'll explain why. I think right now, we're talking about pendulums swinging back and forth. We put somebody in office who had very little political experience. And I think, again, even in the supporters of Trump, in their heart of hearts, many of them know that we're paying some prices for that. Not as many as maybe people on the left are asserting. I think this is going to be a good era for experience. I would like to believe that, at least, maybe projecting my own desires on it. But I think Biden presents an image of experience and knowledge that I think is what people are pretty hungry for at the moment on the Democratic side. What he lacks, however, is this novelty factor. You know, we're always looking for diversity on the Democratic side, and he's got that going against him. He's an older white male, right? And so that's where someone like Harris actually would have had a pretty good position. But I think his experience, and if he plays it properly, watches what he says and what he doesn't say, I think he's got a really good chance there. And in the polls thus far, that's what's showing up.
You know, they talk about it being a base election, and in some sense it is, but it's also on the Democratic side, maybe the Republicans too, but I think the Trump folks feel that with a base election, they can still carry it if they stay in their electoral boundaries that gave it the first time, that they can pull it off for a second time. But for the Democrats, the electoral boundaries of mobilizing their traditional constituencies are there, but at the same time, beating Trump at all expense is also there. And that leads them to think about who would win, independent of the kinds of positions that they're pulling for. The fascinating thing, again, also is the tremendous support for Biden from African Americans.
Yes.
Whereas Cory Booker and Kamala Harris from New Jersey and California, respectively, never get beyond, well, Harris was up high, but, you know, 5 or 6%, 7% of the vote, and popular in the polls, and also just don't take off amongst the in the African American community. I think Bloomberg is hoping that Biden stumbles, or that the fumbling and whatnot will let him then occupy that slot, and that when they're looking for older, middle, it's me, Mayor Mike, President Mike, let's make it happen. I think that's the strategy. On Super Tuesday, I think a place like California with millions of voters, you can't be out in every little thing like Iowa, that you spend a lot of money on TV advertising. They can do it. We got the sign from John. We got to go to break. Stick with us. We're going to end up the last part of the show on who's going to win the 2020 election. Boy, that's that music. I got the signal from John that you're on. He points through the window at me, meaning, Al, get this thing going. The clock's burning. We got to keep moving here. So we are. Al Bergeson, host Smart Talk with Chris Segrin, professor of communications, head of the communications department at the University of Arizona. And we are talking about the election in 2020. 790-2040, 790-2040. That's the call-in number. Give us a call. Tell us who you think's going to win in 2040. And we will try and handicap it, almost like sports talk radio, on who's going to win the Super Bowl. Chris, you got any thoughts?
Well, the job for the Democrats is to stand up somebody who has the wherewithal to beat President Trump in an election. Let's assume that this, first of all, Al, the landscape here is very complicated, because if there's an impeachment beforehand, everything I just said about beating the president is not going to be that relevant. Could be literally being who can beat President Pence. Stop and think about that for a second.
What's the chances of that, though, that the Republicans are going to roll over and vote for impeachment?
Quite slim. Quite slim.
Thank you.
So I think for the time being, the strategy ought to be, which candidate can we stand up who has the wherewithal to knock off the sitting president? That's always a tough thing, because incumbents always have the favorite odds, essentially.
Will Trump replace Pence?
Trump replace Pence?
On the ticket.
Oh, on the ticket. Oh, that's a good question.
It's my job.
It might work well to his advantage. Pence is not. I don't think he's energized support or much opposition. He's been kind of a neutral person. So if Trump really wants to shore up his position, he might consider doing that. But it's going to be the big challenge will be for the Democrats to come up with a person who can knock the person off. And I think what's going to happen is, as we'll see in the upcoming months, these candidates are going to start dropping off, and they're going to probably, I would predict, you'll see Biden likely move to the front. These individuals who are sort of going out on these campaign rallies and messaging with these sort of pandering, free college tuition and free health care, you know, this reminds me of the bread and circus era of times gone by, where you try to placate the public. And I think if Biden just sort of stays the course with a fairly conservative message, by that I mean not too far out there, not too much with entitlements and being sensitive to the problems and concerns, he stands a good chance of emerging. And then it'll be again him against Trump at that point. And then going back to what we were talking about earlier, maybe these impeachment proceedings will soften up Trump enough, if you will, that voters might start to turn in another direction. But do not, to my message to my Democratic friends, is do not underestimate that man's ability to get reelected.
You know, it's interesting. Trump and Biden almost have the same message. So Trump said a while ago, you know, folks, you have no choice but to vote for me. And at first I sort of reacted and said, God, that's awful nervy. I mean, what the hell? People got to write that. Then he's absolutely right. To his base, he's going, folks, calculate it. Who else is going to do conservative justice? Who else is going to do this? Who else is going to do that? And then the scare tactic, if you let them in with their socialism and all that kind of, you got no choice. It doesn't matter who I am. It doesn't matter what I do. You got no choice. Biden almost has the same message. In fact, he would get probably more in trouble if he talked about specific issues he'd do for America. What he needs to say is, folks, get real. I'm the only middle-aged, non-threatening, return to normalcy. And he's like Trump in the sense that Trump's things he says that the base loves because he's authentic, Biden seems authentic too. Bumbling, stumbling. It's not like he's got some secret agenda. You know exactly what he does. He lets it slip out. He screws up. And the irony of irony is, rather than bringing him down, it makes you feel comfortable with him. He's just like us. He's not really a politician. And something like that. And he does real well. It is interesting about Pence. People have noted that you rarely see on a panel the Pope, the Dalai Lama, the Canterbury chief of the Church of England on the same panel. And the question is why? They're all people of God. And the answer is divas. They are all divas. Mm-hmm. And you just will never see them together. Pence is therefore perfect for Trump, because what you want is someone who, look at all the assistants in the White House who were canned because they talked too much. And Greg, you're back. I see it on my screen here. You've got a prediction. Okay, give it to us.
It's going to be, am I on?
Yes,
you're
sir.
On, Greg.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's going to be Hillary Clinton. She's already won. So she won the popular vote. She's kind of let all these other candidates struggle against each other. spend their money. And she's got plenty of money. I think she's worth $40 or $50 million, just her.
Would you vote for her? Bingo.
So probably.
Thank you.
But Bernie Sanders is a better option for some reasons, but I don't know. I don't think he can win. So, but against her, against Trump, I don't know. Yeah, that's the problem. But she won the popular vote. I don't know why she isn't here again.
That's a good point. Now, you see pieces in the paper saying she's thinking about, or they're thinking, someone's thinking about her jumping back in the race. You think that's going to happen?
I think so. I think Bernie Sanders having a heart attack really affected I think it affected everything, because I think he could have sort of moved into that first position. And I don't know, I thought Kamala Harris was going to be
I know. I think
way up front. What happened to her?
Amen. No one fully understands that. It's ironic that in the age of young people and the baby boomers aging, we have candidates on both sides of the aisle. It's the age of the geriatrics. I mean, I'm waiting for an op-ed piece like that. The age of the geriatrics. Stumbling, bumbling this, a heart attack that. You're in your 70s already. It's incredible.
Bloomberg? Yeah, what is Bloomberg, 70-something?
He's up there. Yeah. All right, Greg, thanks for the call. Richard, you're on the air. You got a prediction.
I'm going to have to go with a Democrat because Hillary's not going to run. But because last time there was an anti-Hillary vote, and even though she won by 3 million, you know, a lot of people voted against her. The Clintons are not well-liked in our country whatsoever. In fact, neither party is well-liked anymore in America. That's the problem. Both parties are highly extremist. They have damaged our country. They have damaged other nations around the world. They are killing and bombing around the world today, doing un-American things. We've declared war on nobody. These two parties are horrible.
So, Richard, do you think it's time for an independent candidate? Richard, do you think it's time for an independent candidate?
There's a stranglehold on our electoral system, Al. The Democrats or Republicans are just two sides of the same coin, and we will have to vote for Joe Biden to get rid of this mentally ill president.
All right.
He's damaging us across the board.
All right. Great call, Richard.
You betcha.
Thank you.
Richard,
appreciate it.
You let me remind you that it was President Eisenhower who said, "The left and the right are both the gutters. If you want to get anywhere, you have to drive down the middle of the road." That's what Richard's talking about right now.
Oh, interesting.
Not a new idea. It's an old one. It's an accurate one.
That is a very interesting. So let's put ourselves in the White House or the West Wing. We're the advisors to President Trump. And I'm just the chairman of this committee. I go, so Chris, what do you think the president should do to get reelected?
He's got to begin by humanizing his own faults. He is so afraid and unwilling to recognize and admit to any wrongdoing at all. We're all humans, and I think we like other people who go, you know what, my bad, I screwed that up. I could have done that a little bit better. I'm going to learn from that, and we're going to make some corrections. We actually, that humanizes people, and that message, it's a dangerous one because you got to be very careful about exposing your vulnerability when you're surrounded by sharks. But I think he's probably gone too far in the opposite direction. I think he knows at points in time he's screwed up, and he's just very unwilling to admit that. My advice would be take a crack at being a little bit more human, showing some of those that you understand that you're not rubbing everybody the right way, and maybe trying to reach out a little bit more to your opponents and not constantly vilify them.
So as chairman of the Reelect Trump Committee, I'm now going to turn to someone else sitting over there. I'm going to say, Bill, what are you thinking? Bill says, I think we should just double down on what we did before. There ain't no Democrats that are going to change their mind no matter what you say. That is your mea culpa, I'm sorry, whatever. In fact, they're going to see it as weakness. Things are so polarized. It's the base election idea again. You got to run who you are, hit it harder, and then, you know, find ways as you do to label, you know, low energy Jeb, sleepy Biden, sleepy Joe, et cetera, and double down on the Electoral College and the states to get more representation than they should by population-wise. And maybe, again, you can be a minority candidate, meaning you can be someone with less than a popular vote who wins it. Let's bounce off that for half a second. Do you think a protest movement will soon arise amongst Democrats that if they continue to lose elections where they win the popular vote but lose the Electoral College, what you have is an unjust situation. That is, the majority will feel unjust because the minority is able to cling to party, cling to control.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look at the Hong Kong and going back in time, South Africa and similar situations. It's only a matter of time when the minority is sort of in charge and the majority is being put down where you'll have uprisings. It's fairly predictable. So I would be definitely on the lookout for that if this trend continues.
Yeah, I think it makes perfect sense because it runs right against the one, we used to say one man, one vote, one person, one vote situation where you cannot regularly have minority vote candidates win the elections. On the other hand, there is the good side of the argument, which is if you have majority rule, you may have a tyranny. That is, all you need to do is campaign in California, Texas, Florida, and Nebraska. Whoa, is that a city? I never heard of Iowa. What, I get corn in a can. I don't know that Iowa exists. And so there's that worry too. Got thoughts on balancing it?
There's definitely a need for some sort of reform in the system. We should never be in a scenario where we're having, like you said, these minority individuals winning, and that is something that's going to need attention. And I think it's only a matter of time before this tinderbox catches fire.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been asking you for your opinion on who's going to win.
What's yours?
Yeah, thank you. But you obviously can't live in a glass house and throw stones. Well, you can, but it's not going to work here with a smart guy like you sitting right across from me. My guess is, I don't know. Hey, no one does, but I think the strategy for the Democrats is based on what I heard from an op-ed piece interviewing some Hollywood producers about what they thought for Trump. And they were great because, they don't do politics. But they said, with sitcoms, in about 6 years, it just runs out. Good, bad, it just runs out. So, if you get some of that thinking about Trump, the irony would be say nothing, promise nothing, don't push people further in the Trump thing, again, Sleepy Joe, and talk about a return to normalcy. We can decide who we are, what we are later, but just the craziness of what's going on today is too much for us to do. We're down to a few seconds. Got any parting shots, thoughts?
Yeah, great strategy right now along the lines of what you're talking about is just holding a peaceful, steady line. Stay off Twitter, stay off Instagram and Facebook and all the craziness. Don't be the candidate of craziness.
Oh my God, that's it. I hear the music in the background, which means it's time for us to sign out of here. Al Bergerson for Smart Talk again with Chris Siegman. Thanks for coming in, Chris.
Thanks, Al.
See all you guys next time.